From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Like a lot of young women, Jessica Gross has been criticized for her voice. She faced some criticisms when she hosted a podcast, and then there was the time she was interviewing a man for an article in Business Week.
It was a man in his 50s or 60s, and he said, "You sound like my granddaughter." That was the first moment where I felt it was hurting my career beyond just irritating a couple of listeners.
So what's going on here? Why are older people criticizing young men and women, mostly women, for how they speak? Why are they often called out for upspeak and vocal fry? Are those characteristics actual problems? Today we'll talk with journalist Jessica Gross, Penny Eckert, a linguist who studies gender and language, and Susan Sankin, a speech and language pathologist. And Maureen Corrigan will review Julia Pierpont's debut novel. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When I started working in radio in the 1970s, women were first starting to get a foothold in broadcasting. Where I worked then, many women, hosts and guests, were having trouble with sibilance when they were on mic. That is, the mic exaggerated the highest frequency of their S's, making them sound very hissy. Women were told it was a problem with their voices. We women figured that the mics in our studio just weren't designed for women's voices. And I think maybe that was true, because when I moved to WHYY, where there were different mics, it stopped being a problem. This is just a little blip in the long history of women being told there's something wrong with their voices. Now it's taking the form of complaints about upspeak, vocal fry, and what's sometimes called the sexy baby voice. Young women are being told their voices lack authority or are simply annoying. And these complaints aren't just coming from older men. They're coming from older women, including feminists. So what's going on? Are women's voices changing? Are the complainers just resistant to change? Or are there genuine problems with how many young women speak? I have three guests who are each coming from a different perspective. Journalist Jessica Gross is a former senior editor at Slate magazine, who also hosted Slate's podcast, Double X Gab Fest. She's now the editor of Lenny, which is a forthcoming email newsletter about women's issues, politics, and culture from Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor, the producers of HBO's Girls. Dr. Penny Eckert is a professor of linguistics at Stanford University and is co-author of the book Language and Gender. Susan Sankin is a speech and language pathologist who works with non-native speakers and people in a variety of different professions, including actors. Her clients include people who think their speech is interfering with their ability to advance in their careers. Jessica Gross, Susan Sankin, Penny Eckert, welcome all of you to Fresh Air. Jessica, I want to start with you and with the response you got to your voice when you were hosting the Slate podcast. So how did people respond to your voice when they first heard it?
There were some very impassioned commenters on our Facebook page and in my email who objected to my upspeak. I remember one in particular said I sounded like a valley girl and a faux socialite. And there were a couple comments that echoed that, and the tenor of them was pretty nasty. And before that, I had never really thought about my voice one way or the other. No one had ever commented on it to me.
So what was your response when you first heard these negative?
Hurt. Mm-hmm. I was hurt. I mean, that sounds a little silly. I'm a big girl. I write all the time on the internet, and so I'm used to criticism. But there's something really personal about your voice, and especially if it's something you've never thought about as unpleasant. It's not fun to hear that people find it irritating.
Now, the things that some other people found irritating about your voice, did you ask yourself, okay, what percentage of this is sexism? What percentage of this is generational? What percentage of this is like, oh, maybe I have a real problem?
I thought it was probably mostly generational, only because podcasting and radio is such a very specific thing where they're hearing your disembodied voice and they're not seeing you, they're not seeing your presence, they're not seeing your gestures, they're not seeing the whole package. And in my career up to that point, I'd had no problem getting jobs, being in positions of authority, doing well in interviews. And so I didn't really see it as a problem beyond in this one specific context.
So what did you do? I mean, you actually tried to take some voice lessons, right?
Yeah. So that actually wasn't until after I wasn't on the podcast anymore. I had gone freelance, and I was working for a lot of more business-focused publications, whereas previously I had written more about arts and culture. So I remember I was interviewing somebody for an article in Business Week, and it was a man in his 60s, probably 50s or 60s, and he said, "You sound like my granddaughter." And that was meant to say, "I don't really take you that seriously. You sound so young." I think he even asked me how old I was, which as a journalist, that's not really the response you want. And so that was the first moment where I felt it was hurting my career beyond just irritating a couple of listeners, because other listeners had emailed me supportively when I said it would, you know, when these commenters had said they didn't like my voice, other commenters had said, "Well, I like her voice." So then it could just, you could chalk it up to a matter of opinion. But when it was actually in the line of doing journalism that someone seemed to not be taking me seriously enough, that's what gave me pause. And I still found it irritating. And at that point, I found it mildly sexist, because I don't think he would have said something similar to a man, a young man who used some of the verbal tics that perhaps I used. It did make me want to get a handle on it.
So what did you do?
I went to a voice coach once, and she recorded me, and she gave me a couple tips. And in the process of doing interviews, I would say for the next month or two, I used a lot of her tips, and I found some of them helpful, and I found some of them not so helpful. And at this point, that all took place about 2 years ago. And now I don't think about it at all. I don't know if I've internalized some of the things that she taught me or if I've just discarded them because I'm not doing business pieces at all anymore and it doesn't seem to be relevant. But I don't know if it's had lasting import. I'm sure your listeners who may or may not be irritated by my voice can tell you.
Did she change your pitch?
I wouldn't say she changed my pitch. It did make me more aware of the upspeak. I thought about it more. I think sometimes I overcompensated to where I was maybe doing vocal fry, which I know is something else people complain about, just to in an effort to make my voice slightly deeper and more even. I'm doing it right now. I'm doing vocal fry right now. It's just that, and that was sort of why I moved away from it. In some ways, I feel like I can't win and young women can't win, because if we're not doing upspeak, then we're compensating and we're doing something else that people find irritating. It's like advice that women get in the workplace, where it's be aggressive, but don't be too aggressive because that's off-putting. And so ultimately, I found I just had to be myself and not think about it because I wasn't going to win.
I want to read you, you might already have read this, but the podcast 99% Invisible, one of the producers there, Katie Mingle, wrote a letter in response to the emails they get about women's voices. So I just want to read this. "Hello. You've written in to voice your dislike of one of our female reporters' voices. You're not alone. We have a filter set up that automatically sends these types of emails into a folder labeled Zero Priority. We'll review this folder and consider the complaints within, well, never. Amazingly, we don't even have a folder for our complaints about the male voices on our show because we've never gotten one. Isn't that strange? We think so. Anyway, hope you can continue to enjoy our free podcast somehow. And if you can't, there are plenty of shows that don't feature women's voices at all." So that's from 99% Invisible. Very funny letter, I think.
I love that.
Yeah. So, Penny Eckert, you're a linguist, professor at Stanford. Let me bring you into the conversation. What's your reaction to hearing the kinds of criticisms that were directed to Jessica that I'm sure you've heard directed to many women about their voices from people who focus on how irritating they find upspeak or fry?
It makes me really angry. And it makes me angry, first of all, because the biggest users of vocal fry traditionally have been men. And it still is men in the UK, for instance. And it's considered a sign of hypermasculinity. And nobody ever complains that men use vocal fry, even though in the past that has driven me crazy because I thought they're just being hyper-masculine, trying to be authoritative by sounding even lower than everybody else. And the business of these hesitation markers, just and so, those are not female. And yet when people are picking on women, somehow that's female. And by the same token, uptalk. It's clear that in some people's voices that has really become a style, but it's been around forever. And people use it stylistically in a variety of ways, both men and women. So the disparity in people's noticing is just very clear to me. People are busy policing young women's language, and nobody's policing older or younger men's language.
Susan Sankin, as a speech and language pathologist, what's your take on that? Do you think it's people who are policing women?
You know, my experience is more anecdotal, and I think about the people who come to see me, and it's not just young women. It's young men, and it's men and women of other ages as well. Perhaps women take more criticism than men do. I do agree with that, but I don't think they're the only ones who have the problem.
Now, let me
ask. Some people will object to me calling it a problem.
I was going to say, what do you mean by the problem?
Exactly. I knew as soon as the words were out of my mouth. I'm in hostile territory here.
What do you mean by why are you calling it a problem, Susan?
For the people who come to see me, they're unhappy with their speech. They don't like the way they sound. They sound tentative to themselves. They sound unsure to themselves as well. And they feel that when they present themselves, that it sounds as if they lack confidence, even though they're very capable. And they know that they have the capacity to sound better, more confident, more assured with some help. They just have developed a speech pattern that's a habit, and they don't know how to break out of it. When we present ourselves, the way we speak is our verbal image. Much as the way people in the professional world typically don't go to work in sweats and a t-shirt, they are more concerned about how they present themselves. A lot of the clients that come to see me are concerned about how they're presenting themselves verbally. Very often they say that a first image is created from the first words that you utter. So, for example, one of the exercises I do with my clients is to have them introduce themselves and tell me what they do. More often than not, from the very beginning when they say their name, they are using upspeak. If nothing else, the one thing they should be able to say with confidence is their name. When they appear at a meeting or when they're doing a presentation, they need to start by sounding confident from the time that they introduce themselves.
Could I interject a little thing about upspeak?
And this is Penny the linguist chiming in, yes.
So men and women in Australia have been using rising intonation on declarative sentences for a very, very long time. I know an engineer, a man in about his late 60s, who rises at the end of every one of his declarative sentences. And when I first heard him, which was a long time ago, it drove me crazy. But it never occurred to me that he sounded tentative. I just thought, that's a really weird intonational pattern. And it sounded just weird. But the reason that everybody thinks that it sounds tentative, it's because it's women who are doing it. And there's this, I think, this automatic connection between insecurity, which is a female stereotype, and certain kinds of patterns.
Right. But yes. Patterns change. I mean, just to hop off the statement you made about wearing sweatpants, Mark Zuckerberg wears a hoodie to work every day because he's a young man. That's the dominant Silicon Valley way of dressing now. It wasn't 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but now that's what it is. And even young women in Silicon Valley, I've read personal essays about how they don't feel comfortable dressing up and looking cute for work because they feel like it won't get them taken seriously. They also have to wear hoodies and look like Mark Zuckerberg. So it sort of feels like even when the culture is changing, it changes so that usually white men are still the defaults and how we should all be behaving.
I think part of the issue in America is that upspeak, things are ending with a question mark. Even declarative sentences have the kind of melodic style that we associate with a question because questions end in an up, right? So people, I think, associate the fact that it sounds melodically like a question, they associate that with tentativity, uncertainty. But as a couple of you have pointed out, the melodies are changing, and therefore the melodies are indicating different things. Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, there was a really interesting study that the Times cited in 2014 in an article about Upspeak when a linguist cited a Texas sorority used UpTalk to make junior members feel obligated to carry out new tasks. So it was actually an aggressive way of speaking. Yeah. Obviously, that's a very specific milieu, but it can read differently as long as we know to read it differently.
Okay, so there's two things I want to play for all of you and for our audience. And one is, I think it's obligatory when you're doing a discussion on this that you play a clip from Shosh on Girls, the Lena Dunham series Girls, because she's the kind of caricatured queen of upspeak. So here's just a clip from Girls. And this is Zasha Mamet on Girls.
I did something kind of crazy. I made an internet dating profile. Okay, I know it sounds kind of nuts, but my nutrition teacher, who's like so cool, met her boyfriend on Match.com, who's like super cute and totally perf, and they're like the most happy together. And I joined electrichellos.com because it's the most expensive subscription and ugly people do match. And I got this message from this like kind of great sounding guy. His name is Bryce, which like, hello, good name. He works in product development, which is like perfect for me because I love products and he's Jewish.
Okay, so that's a caricature, that character. But I think part of what it's caricaturing, and Jessica, I'd be interested in your response to this since you are editing a new newsletter that Lena Dunham and her co-producer Jenny Connor are publishing on women's issues. So I think part of that character is about being white, maybe suburban. I'm not sure where she's supposed to be coming from, like the city or the suburbs. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people associate that with a suburban sound and with a very middle class sound and with a certain sense of entitlement. I think that's mm-hmm. what her character kind of personifies. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And that some people associate her sound with all of those traits. Mm-hmm. So thoughts? And is that playing into what people think they're hearing?
My take on the whole thing is that attacking or criticizing individuals for the way that they speak is sort of not the point. I feel like you can take any fictional character or any person, and the way that they speak says something about where they're from and who they are. I guess I just object to the idea that young women are the only people who, when they are projecting who they are and where they're from with their voices, are the ones that are criticized for it. Because I'm sure a young man who grew up upper middle class in the suburbs has his own vocal tics. And why aren't those as annoying? Or why aren't those as bad? Or why, you know, it's a sense of judgment and critique that is attached to those upper middle class white suburban traits only when you're talking about a woman. Which is not to say that there's not things to criticize or there isn't a myopia to upper middle class white suburban girls. There completely is. But again, you never see the sort of parallel young man getting made fun of in quite the same way or getting critiqued in quite the same way.
I feel like I hear a lot of young men with upspeak and with vocal fry. Does everybody else hear that too, or?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I honestly don't think about it. Until I read about vocal fry, I never thought of it as a thing until my voice got criticized on the radio. I mean, I had heard of upspeak and people complaining about upspeak, but I hadn't thought about the way I did or did not do it.
Creak usually doesn't happen just by itself. People don't just creak and creak and creak. It's usually because young women are using much wider intonational patterns. So they have higher rises and lower falls, and the lower fall brings them into the lower end of their pitch range so that their vocal cords start vibrating aperiodically. And frequently, I mean, we've used creak forever. I mean, Mae West used creak to show sort of sexiness. Creak is something that happens when there's low subglottal pressure. So it has been always used to show that you're tired, to show that you're sick, sometimes, and or even satisfied, sexually satisfied, or if you've eaten something really good or you're tasting chocolate, people use creak to show their satisfaction. They say, oh, I love chocolate.
And I just want to point out, when you say creak, that's the sound a lot of people call vocal fry or glottal
fry. Yeah, linguists call it creak, and other people call it vocal fry.
My guests are linguist Penny Eckert, speech and language pathologist Susan Sankin, and journalist Jessica Gross. We'll talk about generational differences and how young women's voices are perceived after we take a short break. And Maureen Corrigan will review an enjoyable novel about an unhappy family. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives. We're talking about young women's voices. This is Fresh Air. Some people trace the growth of creak, can I put it that way? The widening.
The stylization of creek.
Yeah, right? The stylization of creek to the Kardashians. And so I'm going to play a clip from the Kardashians from their reality TV show and then ask you if you think there's any connection, if you think there's any validity in saying that they helped spread creek or fry. So here's the Kardashians. Kim speaks first.
I think you look amazing.
Really?
Like, amazing. Like, I'm loving this short hair. You just, will you, like, bank
a
couple selfies?
I love the short hair, right?
Why, what? Just bank a couple selfies.
Yeah. I did my makeup so fast, I'm just not feeling myself.
Your lips look amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
Kendall said they were too big yesterday.
Are you talking about her lips?
Mm-hmm. I don't want you to get, like, carried away. Lips aren't permanent. But, like, if they ask about your lips, like, own up to it.
I don't know why you guys are even freaking out or talking about this, though.
Okay, so that's a clip from the Kardashians. So let's ask the linguist, Penny Eckert. Is there any connection, do you think, to the Kardashians and their reality TV show and the spread of creak or vocal fry?
Well, it was, I mean, they're doing something that was already around, right? They're doing it for a reason. They didn't invent it. But I think one of the ways that this is spreads, and this is a couple of my students who have got sort of absolutely convinced of this, that people imitate the Kardashians, they mock them, and then gradually, as part of it, it's kind of a joke. But then you incorporate that into your own style when you're making the kinds of social moves that the Kardashians are making. So it creeps into people's styles, but not necessarily, oh, they talk like that, so I'm going to talk like that.
Now, two examples I just played you of the character of Shoshone Girls and now the Kardashians. These are characters, you know, the character of Shosh is a caricature, and the Kardashians are mocked so frequently in our culture. And so I don't want to be saying that figures of mockery are the roots of how women speak today. I just want to make it clear I'm choosing these because these are like extreme edges and that people cite them as exemplary of certain speech issues.
But I don't necessarily think they should be figures of mockery. I mean, Kim Kardashian has a multimedia empire.
Yes.
Yes, she is mocked and so are lots of other public figures. I find myself wanting to defend Kim. And yes, Shoshone is a character and a caricature, but she has a lot of admirable qualities as well. So, I mean, I don't object so much to these examples.
So here's a question with vocal fry. There are people who say it's really bad for your vocal cords. And I think, Susan, you have that position. And there are linguists who say, not true. There are a lot of cultures where people just speak that way. And Penny, I think that's your position. Can you each like?
Well, I haven't seen any medical evidence that it is dangerous for your vocal cords. I think that if somebody yelled a whole lot, they might damage their vocal cords. But there are languages in which voice quality is what we, you know, is phonemic, as we say, so that the same word pronounced with creaky voice has a different meaning from this, from a word spoken with breathy voice or with what we call modal voice. And in fact, I haven't heard anybody rushing British men to the hospital because they use a lot of creak.
Susan, as a speech and language pathologist, your thoughts on whether creak or fry has vocal consequences in terms of your vocal cords and the health of your voice?
Right. I have heard ENTs say that it can cause damage. And for a lot of the languages where it's a habitual pattern, as you develop from a young age, that's how you're training and using your vocal cords. And I think when you start to fall into that pattern later on, I think that it can cause some damage. Again, I'm not a doctor, so I can't say that I've looked at people's vocal cords and I've seen it, but I have heard ENT say that they do notice that it can cause damage. And sometimes the jury is out on that as well. But
I was going to say, how do they know that that's what's causing it?
I guess it depends on what they get from a clinical examination, both in terms of what they're hearing and what they're seeing.
I think in a lot of ways that the changes that people are hearing in women's voices are becoming normative, that if there's been a generational change, my perception is that it's becoming just more and more like that's how people sound. And I want to play an example of that. There's a Sam Adams beer commercial narrated by a young woman who has some amount of creak or fry in her voice. And I think this ad is an example of how just normative it is. So let's just hear it and then we can talk.
At Sam Adams, we celebrate the independence that made us an original craft beer pioneer. We bring our best friends to work. We treat every day like casual Friday. We take beer seriously, not ourselves. We brew beers we want to drink. We hold ourselves to our own standards.
Okay, so that's an ad. Penny Eckert, the linguist on our panel, thoughts?
Yeah, well, of course, I actually did an experiment about a year ago. I played the same woman using sort of a creaky voice, and I played another clip of her not using that style. And it was just a very short clip. It's like, he says da-da-da-da-da, right? And then another one where the fall, there's not so much a fall and there's no creak. Like, he says da-da-da. And it was really stunning because people over the age of 40 heard the more conservative utterance as authoritative, whereas the young people were more likely to find both of them authoritative, but also the older people thought the conservative one was more authoritative than the younger people did. So there's been a change, and those of us who are bothered by some of these features are probably just getting old.
Do you put yourself in the category of people who are bothered by some of those features as a listener?
Yes. Yeah, I have to. I'm a linguist. I'm a sociolinguist. I love change. I love stylistic stuff. But I'm also a person in the world with my prejudices and so on. So, yeah, I have. But it bothers me only when it becomes just all over the place. Because I was shocked the first time I heard the style in NPR. I took it. I thought, oh, my God, how can this person be talking like this on the radio? And then I played it for my students, and I said, how does she sound? And they said, oh, good, authoritative. And that was when I knew that I had a problem.
That you had a problem?
Sure, yeah, that I had a problem, that I was not part of the generation that understood what that style means, because styles have meaning. And one of the things is everybody's trying to guess what that meaning is. So people are running around saying that younger women are using creak so they can sound more authoritative. Well, that's just based on the knowledge that men have lower voices. That's really jumping to a ridiculous conclusion. And I don't think that older people are in a position to figure out what this what these features actually mean, but they're meaningful.
Jessica, I'd be interested in your reaction to hearing that commercial, that ad.
It's funny. I've seen that commercial on TV a bunch, and I never noticed her voice, but hearing it disembodied was annoying. I feel like a traitor saying that, but it really I've found it irritating. So I wouldn't have noticed it in context, but now that it's pulled out of its context, that was my reaction.
And I liked it.
No, it's, everybody's got tastes and opinions.
Susan, our speech and language pathologist, your take?
I certainly did not like it.
Because?
I continue to feel that glottal fry used in that way and also upspeak used as pervasively as it's using is just distracting from the message. For me, and I know for a lot of people, it appears to distract from what people are trying to say. And it just, I've heard what everybody's been saying. It still has a feeling to me of sounding hesitant, less sure of yourself, and less decisive. And I might be old, too.
I was going to say, you are
but,
over 40,
but, you know,
right?
Yeah, I definitely am. But, there are a lot of other things that I really like in spite of my age. And this just happens to be one of the things that I think is just an irritating way of speaking.
In thinking about how our perception of voices, and particularly of women's voices, changes over time, I know when I started in radio, which was back in the 70s, women's voices were not considered authoritative.
Right.
You didn't find women on the radio, period. Maybe you had like the sexy FM late night DJ. That was about it. Sure, there were occasional exceptions, but they were the exceptions that proved the rule. Susan Stamberg on NPR was the first woman to anchor a national news show, and she really broke ground there. And NPR, that was like the first place where you had there was a woman congressional correspondent at the same time that there was a woman legal correspondent, at the same time that there was a woman anchoring the news. It was kind of remarkable. And things have changed, I think, a lot since then. But there's still a lot of stigma attached to a lot of women's speaking styles. Go ahead.
Now, I agree with that. And particularly, so when I first started teaching in 1973, I lowered the pitch of my voice intentionally in order to be taken seriously. I mean, I was one of three women in a faculty of 35 people, in a department of 35 people. And it was clear they didn't want me there, or some people didn't want me there. Now we get new assistant professors. They're not worried about trying to sound authoritative. I have a colleague who has a very high, girly voice. And it's not a problem. And it may be a problem for some people, but you only get change by not allowing it to be a problem to you. And I think this is something that has been huge in all of the years that people have been studying minority dialects. African-American vernacular English is a very rich dialect. And yet little kids are told they better not speak that if they want to succeed in the world. So the question is, do you knuckle under to that? Or do you try to make the world change a little bit? And certainly, that's how I feel about a lot of the women's styles, is that if we all cower under and say, do what I did in 1973, well, then what's going to change?
Susan, I have a question for you. And Susan is the speech and language pathologist on our panel. When you were on a few weeks ago, in part one of this conversation, and we were talking about the movie Do I Sound Gay, and then I kept you to just talk with you about your work helping people who come to you who are non-native speakers and they want help with learning how to speak fluently and understandably, and other people who do public speaking or whatever and come to you for help. I asked you about your own speaking style and if you had changed, and you talked about how you used to have a very thick Jersey accent, and when you started to do this work, you tried to get rid of the Jersey accent, and you succeeded. And some people in our audience were very upset by that. And they thought that that was the equivalent of like being African American and lightening your skin. And that it was just like erasing your authentic voice to try to sound more normative. And I'd really like to hear your response to that.
I heard from some of those people.
Did you?
I did. And this is what I'll say. For me, the way I spoke was not, I didn't think, reflected who I was. It also interfered with my ability to professionally do what I wanted to do. I needed to be a better role model for my clients, and speaking with a nasal New Jersey pattern did not allow me to do that. So, you know, I know some people were offended by that, and what I would say is, if you like the way you sound, if you're comfortable with your speech, that's great. But if you feel that it interferes with what your personal or professional goals are, that's when you correct it or change it.
One of the things we look for when we're considering somebody as a guest on the show is that they're expressive, whether they have, you know, no matter what kind of speaking style they have, we want them to be expressive and engaging. And there's the ways of doing that with every kind of voice. It's the monotone that I think is the biggest problem. Yeah. You know, the droning monotone, like it's so easy to stop paying attention. And Jessica, I was talking to you earlier about the comments you got about your voice when you were doing a podcast for Slate. But I mean, you have an expressive voice.
Yes.
And you have a range of notes in your voice.
Well, that was actually part of why I think I abandoned what the voice coach told me, was because I felt like it was blunting my emotional range. I felt when I was self-conscious about my voice, it lost that expressive, connective quality, which is also important for a journalist to have. So I'm talking less about how I appeared on the podcast, but how I appeared when I was doing interviews. And I really felt like there was something, especially during phone interviews, there was something lost when I wasn't being myself, whatever that is. So I don't know. I mean, it's a tough question. I mean, I have started thinking of voice almost as the way I think about outfits. If I'm going for a job interview, I'm going to wear a different outfit than when I'm out with my friends. And before, I wouldn't have thought, oh, I use a different voice when I'm at a job interview and when I'm out with my friends. And now I do think of it a little bit more as these two separate things, whereas before I had zero awareness of it. And I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's just about wanting to change for yourself instead of feeling like you're being forced to change by external forces.
That's a very good distinction, right. Jessica Gross, Penny Eckert, Susan Sankin, thank you all for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Jessica Gross is the editor of Lenny, which is a forthcoming email newsletter from Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor about women's issues, politics, and culture. Dr. Penny Eckert is a professor of linguistics at Stanford University and is co-author of the book Language and Gender. Susan Sankin is a speech and language pathologist at Sankin Speech Improvement in New York. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another NPR podcast about pop culture you might want to check out, Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. He interviews musicians, writers, filmmakers, comedians, and others about their work and their lives. A just-published debut novel about an age-old topic has caught the attention of our book critic, Maureen Corrigan. Here's her review of Among the 10,000 Things.
Talk about opening with a bang. At the beginning of Julia Pierpont's debut novel, Among the 10,000 Things, an 11-year-old girl named Kay Shanley enters the lobby of her New York City apartment building. We readers have already been clued into the fact that Kay is the kind of awkward, shy, preteen other girls ridicule. We just want her to get safely into her family's apartment and back to watching the Harry Potter movies she loves. But just as the elevator doors are closing, the doorman signals for her to hold up. He hands her a package addressed to her mom, who's called Deb. because the flaps of the package are merely tucked in, not taped, because Kay spies something pink where the flaps don't meet, and because that spot of pink makes her hope the package is a present for her that her mom has ordered, Kay opens it. Before you can say Pandora's box, evil flies out in the form of pages and pages of printed emails, many of them graphically erotic, between Kay's father and a woman he has had an affair with. Kay doesn't even know the meaning of some of the words she sees, but she does get the meaning of the cover note, the obscenely pink thing that lured her in. It's a letter from the other woman to Kay's mother, and it reads in part, "Dear Deborah, I began sleeping with your husband last June. We were together for 7 months. If Pierpont simply took it from there and chronologically traced the fallout of this terrible knowledge on Kay, her older brother Simon, and her parents, then Among the 10,000 Things would deserve a nod as a closely observed work of domestic fiction." But what sets Pierpont apart from the pack of other accomplished young graduates of elite creative writing programs, she went to NYU, is her storytelling chops. The chapters that follow that dramatic opening make it clear that there are going to be as many ingenious twists and turns in this literary novel as there are in a top-notch work of suspense like Gone Girl. The effect is dizzying. As a reader, you feel, as the Shanleys do, that the earth keeps shifting beneath your feet. Early on, here's how we're told that Jack Shanley, an artist and the dad now in the doghouse, somewhat smugly assumes the future will play out. His wife would fight with him, really just yell, because who can fight with a spineless thing, a misshapen, regretful thing that curls up and sleeps with white flags waving like windshield wipers? She'd get sick of yelling, of crying. When she cried, Kay cried, Simon cried. They'd speak to him only when his physical presence was an impediment, when he was blocking the refrigerator and they needed him to move. And then they'd be over-polite. Because Pierpont doesn't want her readers to get caught up solely in the suspense about whether or not Kay's parents will stay together or divorce, she does something nervy right in the middle of this novel. She inserts a glimpse into the future. Then, after our curiosity about the Shanleys is satisfied, we readers are asked to turn our full attention back to those first raw weeks after that box of printed emails arrives. Smart. Pierpont's gift for offbeat construction and for telling descriptions extends to less weighty scenes as well. There are comic moments scattered around here, mostly via quick, wry observations. When, for instance, Deb, a former ballet dancer, heads off to meet a more successful dancer friend, we're told that the two women were going to lunch because each had been waiting for the other to cancel. Making dates only to call them off was how they kept in touch. Among the 10,000 Things may deal with that familiar staple of fiction, unhappy families, but it does so in such unexpected ways that it's a fresh pleasure to read. In fact, it's such a pleasure that you almost forget that everyone you care about in this novel is miserable.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed the novel Among the 10,000 Things by Julia Pierpont. If you'd like to catch up on recent interviews you missed with people like Jake Gyllenhaal, Ian McKellen, and Amy Schumer with Judd Apatow, check out our podcast. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.